Welcome to the Invest with Clarity podcast, where you will learn how success in investing, as in life, is the result of absolute clarity. Mark Pearson of Nepsis in Minneapolis, Minnesota, shares his passion for portfolio management and commitment to transparency and communication to allow investors to fully understand what they own and why, bringing them to clarity in their investments. And now, here are your co-hosts, Matt Halloran and Mark Pearson.
Hello and welcome to another Invest with Clarity podcast with Mark Pearson. Today, we are going to pray for a pullback. Now, that seems wildly counterintuitive, Mr. Pearson. And just so everybody knows, Mark has been a little bit under the weather. And so, you know, if his voice is a little bit scratchier than normal, it's just because he's been sick. But he decided to come on the show today because he's got some really great information. He's got his great energy back. He's ready to kick some butt and take some names. And he's ready to go. So praying for a pullback, brother. Wow. Where are we here?
Wow. I mean, I don't even know. Boy, you set the expectations so high for me today. I don't even know what to do.
I'm praying for you to be wrong one of these days. One of them. That's all. Just one day. I'm going to dance. I'm going to put it on video. I'm going to like post it on social media the day I get you to get caught up. Hasn't happened yet.
I wish you the best of luck, my friends.
Nobody wants to really see me dance, brother. Nobody does. So, all right. Praying for a pullback. So yeah. Why? Why?
Well, here's the mentality of the average investor. So let's start with a couple of premises. Premise number one is that the majority of investing by individual investors is not structural in nature. It is not fundamental in nature. It is emotional in nature. So that's premise number one, right? And if you disagree with these premises, of course, you are more than welcome to, you know, raise your hand, say, you know, no way, Mark. Premise number two is investors don't ever like to talk about their losers. They only like to talk about their winners, right? So are those two premises in your opinion, would you agree with those two things?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. All right. So with that being said, we right now are in a very precarious position within the markets and the economy. It is, as we are recording this today, it is February 13th of 2020, and the S&P 500 year-to-date is already up 4.65%. The ACWI, which is a global benchmark, if you will, index, is up 2.86. The NASDAQ is up a paltry, by the way, NASDAQ is up a paltry 8.52%. And the Dow is up 3.37. So you're midway through February. You've actually already, whether you realized it or not, have experienced somewhere in the neighborhood of a 3-4% pullback back in after the market started strong when the coronavirus was introduced. A pullback began. And the coronavirus is what they refer to in the investment world as a black swan event, right? We've talked about black swan events, or the one-off events that you can't plan for, right? That you must always be prepared for. But as I go back to the two premises, right? They only like to talk about their winners, right? And you know, the emotional predisposition of the investor. It's important for people to understand that when it comes to investing, I believe more than anything else, Matt, that the first thing that has to be fixed, I shouldn't say fixed, should be made sure that it's at check, is the psychological predisposition of the investor. In other words, managing the emotions. You know, have you ever thought about how investors, you know, spend all this time with their advisor doing a risk tolerance questionnaire, right? Or an investment policy statement questionnaire, right? What are those designed to do? They're designed to match the allocation strategy with the risk tolerance and investment objectives of that investor. Now, one of the things that you and I have talked about, and I want to reiterate this again, I fundamentally believe, without question, not even open to debate, is that volatility does not equate risk. Volatility equates opportunity. Because if the long-term value, the long-term value or the long-term fundamentals of a business that you invest in haven't changed, if the price goes down 5, 10, 20, 30% in a short period of time, why wouldn't that be a buying opportunity if things haven't changed, right? But Wall Street teaches investors, Matt, to be thinking that volatility equates to risk. Well, if that's the case, why go through all the work of doing an investment policy questionnaire or a risk tolerance questionnaire?
I have never understood that.
Right. I mean, it's counterintuitive. Why don't we go do this big questionnaire, make sure you got your risk tolerance set, and then, oh, by the way, let's just talk about volatility corrections and how risky they are. No. The fact of the matter is that many financial advisors don't necessarily take a hands-on approach to managing money. It's a cookie cutter process. We've talked about this in the past as well, that the industry has moved in this period of everything's just cookie cutter. You know, you set your allocation, you measure it to your investment objectives, and you let it go. When the fact of the matter is that the greatest tool available to the investor is volatility. This is why Warren Buffett's talked about it for decades. So why not take advantage of it? So praying for a pullback. Let me give you some nice little stats, Uncle Matt. You ready?
Can I ask you a quick question first before you give me the stats?
Okay. Lay it on me.
My experience in working with financial services professionals is the reason why they do a risk tolerance is a CYA, right? So it's to cover their bum in order to prove that they're trying to act in a fiduciary manner and have actually had a risk conversation with the client. Why? You've been doing this for a long time, right? And I know that you have advisors talk to you from all over the country. Why do you think they equate that with being a fiduciary? I'm absolutely blown away by that expectation, or that expectation is not the right word, that opinion, that by me telling you that you're a 32 on the risk assessment test, that actually freaking means something. Help me with that.
Correct. Well, that's why I love that, you know, there's these programs out now where you give yourself a number, right? Risk, first of all, most importantly, is not absolute. Your risk tolerance is not absolute. It is a function of your emotional ability to manage through uncertainty. That, I mean, people don't sue you because you're making tons of money for them.
Right.
They come after you because you stunk it up for them, or they felt that you were quote unquote invested too aggressively.
Aggressively. Yeah, totally. Those are words we hear all the time.
I don't even understand what that even means, to be quite frank about it. But it's the attempt, I believe, of the industry to put things in a box. Investing is not about boxes. Investing is about a continuum. It is about a process. It is about a strategic and a tactical component to the process. There is the strategic component, which is, okay, global asset allocation, growth and income, balanced income and growth or income, right? That's the strategic. The tactical component of it is markets expand and contract. Stock prices expand and contract. Let me give you what I would consider to be maybe a legitimate example of what I'm talking about here.
Cool.
So everyone knows Apple, right?
Yes.
Is Apple a risky stock?
Well, no. I don't know. Well, I don't know how to answer that, dude. Now, hold on. I don't know how to answer that because of everything, one, that I've learned from you, and two, Apple at one point was the greatest bargain you could have ever purchased in your entire portfolio. So I don't know.
Hence I rest my case. Is Apple a risky stock? You know, people will say, you know, are utility stocks risky? You know, during the financial crisis, utility stocks went down as much as everything else did. What's risk? In other words, if a stock goes down 30, 40, 50, 60%, is that really considered risk? Because the problem with the industry is we are basing risk decisions on a snapshot in time. Let me give you an example. On December 12th, now listen, follow this carefully. On December 12th, 1980, Apple went public at 51 cents a share. This is split adjusted. Okay. This is 1980. I remember when it went public, I was 15 years old at the time. In 1985, 5 years later, it was at 40 cents. So 5 years later, Apple went from 50 cents to 40 cents. I'm not a rocket scientist, but I believe that's a 20% pullback.
Mm-hmm.
Right? By 1990, all of a sudden, in 10 years, the stock was at $1.46. So $1.50. So let's take it 50 to a buck to a buck and a half. You're up 150% in 10 years. That averages 15% per year. Let me sidebar for a second. Let me ask a rhetorical question. Why is it that people are willing to buy variable annuities that are laden with fees for this quote-unquote protection of the downside? I just absolutely love protection of the downside, but will sign up for it and have 5, 7, 10, 12-year surrender periods. In other words, or frankly, because they have these protective measures, a lot of these variable annuities, people end up holding on to them forever because they can't. It doesn't make sense to get rid of them at some point. And the bottom line with those annuities is that the investor has made a long-term investment decision, right? Because they're going to hold it for years. Follow me?
Mm-hmm.
Why don't people do that with stocks despite the volatility? I've said this before on the podcast. The average holding period back when our parents were buying stocks was like, I think it was like 9 years or 7 years.
Yeah.
I don't remember, 7.3 years.
Yeah, I thought you said eight previously. Yeah.
Is that what it is? Yeah. Eight, yeah. And now at the average is 9 months.
Yeah, I know.
So you'll buy an annuity, but you won't hold Apple for 10 years.
Yeah.
And you would have made 15% per year on your stock, right? So I want to fast forward real quick and go from 1990 to about, let's call it 1995. So another 5 year period. Stock hadn't changed. In 5 years, the stock was still $1.50. Isn't that interesting?
It is. I didn't know that.
Right. I'll even make it worse for you. By 1997, 17 years after Apple went public, it was at 58 cents.
Oh.
It was very near where it started.
Yeah, yeah.
In 17 years. Now, go from 1997. Remember the tech bull market in the late 1990s?
Yeah, and
all the tech stocks 01, making all that money.
Yeah. Tech bubble 01, yeah.
Yeah. Apple was at $1.20. So in other words, from 1995 to 1999, let's even go to the peak of 2000 in January, right? I mean, of December of 89, it was somewhere in the neighborhood of around, call it, actually it popped. So it went from like $1.35 in February of 99, stock almost doubled.
Oh.
So by the end of the year of 99, all of a sudden, boom. Now, note this. In 1 year, the stock went from basically $1.50 to $3.68.
Wow.
Which means it more than doubled.
Yeah, yeah.
And from 1980, 20 years later, the stock at $3.70, $3.80 from 50 cents, that's 50, $1 to $2. That's almost a three bagger in 20 years.
Mm.
Divide that by 20 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this thing goes, and by the way, I don't know if you know the story, but on a pre-split adjusted basis, Matt, that stock basically went from a dollar when it went public or something like that, up to $100, went all the way back to a dollar.
Wow.
Most people don't realize that. It was almost bankrupt. So they bring Steve Jobs back in, right? And the long story short, now by 2005, which is 5 years later, the stock's at $7.33. So the stock has doubled in 5 years again, right? So you then go, let's just go out to 2012. Apple was $75. Long story short, today it's at $325 a share. It's a $1.4 trillion stock. Why am I going through that exercise? I'm going through that exercise to explain that it is not timing a stock. It is not timing a stock. It is not timing an investment.
Mm-hmm.
It is time in an investment. And if you took the opportunity on pullbacks to buy more of Apple, obviously you would have made a lot of money. I mean, have you ever asked yourself why people ever sold Berkshire Hathaway in 1990?
No, I mean, yes, I have always wondered that. But the other thing that I've always wondered is the, okay, this is, I might take this where we have to go in a different podcast, but you just really triggered something that I want to have you dive in a little bit more deeply. Mm-hmm. So you are talking about the fundamentals. We talk about that a lot on the podcast. And I know part of that is, you know, your investment team and kind of secret sauce-ish, but I think the reason why people equate a lot of this stuff to volatility and risk is because they don't understand how to look at the stocks themselves. So you're talking about a company that a lot of people thought was going to go under, right?
Yep.
But their fundamentals were good. They were, I'm assuming, at some point, or they wouldn't be where they are right now. And part of that also was some very strategic positions and some really good product opportunities. But how do you figure this out? I mean, there are thousands and thousands of companies that we can invest in.
Well, that's a great point, and it's a great question. And in my opinion, there are a lot of individual investors who make a lot of money, and I'll just be blunt and say they're lucky.
Yeah, totally.
They're just lucky.
Yeah.
There are some people who are individual investors that can look at fundamentals and make an investment decision, because the reality is there is a multitude of variables that go into the valuation of a business. And sometimes that is not logical. I mean, the greatest example of that today is Tesla, right? I mean, Tesla has gone parabolic. It's gone through the roof from $250 a share, went up to over $900 a share about a week or so ago. I mean, the thing has just gone parabolic very quickly. And this is what I try to tell our clients. You have to understand that while people think volatility is risk, it actually isn't. Volatility is opportunity. The other thing that people have to understand is that the up and down movements of a stock price is relative. It is relative. In other words, there's not always a reason why a stock goes up or a stock goes down. There can be multiple factors that are affecting the short-term value of that stock. Let's take a look at JD.com. JD.com, big China company, goes from $20 up to $45, $48 a share, goes all the way back down to $19 a share in 2018 during the China pullback. Today, only to be sitting at $41 or $42 a share again. And if you're a long-term investor in a big company like that, if you were smart, you bought a lot of it when it went back down to $19, $20, $22 a share because nothing really had ultimately changed. There was just some economic things that had happened. So in my opinion, this is just my opinion. I think most individual investors shouldn't be doing their own stock investing. Right. They should be working with a money management firm or an advisor that provides a level of clarity, a level of service that the investor can sit and watch the businesses that they own in their portfolio. And for a lack of a better phrase, let the professionals manage the process, right?
Yes.
Picking a stock is not about picking a stock. It is about an investment process. So there are too many variables that go into why a stock goes up or down at any given point. So when I make the statement at the top of the show, praying for a pullback, you always, as an investor, rule number one, always, always, always in the back of your head, be prepared for a 20% pullback. Always. A 20% pullback should be considered status quo. If you're not selling the investments, if you're not needing the money that is invested aggressively, you should view the 20% correction as an opportunity. The stuff that you don't want to have a 20% correction, i.e. more conservative, let those investments go and not worry about it. But have you ever done like your tax return, right? And you think you're going to get $1,000 back and you're pretty happy about getting $1,000, right? But you end up getting $3,000 back. How do you feel?
I don't know. That's never happened to me, but I'm assuming it feels great.
For most people, when they get their tax refunds, they're excited if they if the tax refund has outdone their expectations.
Right.
I've used this all the time. Warren Buffett, one of my favorite phrases, the key to success is low expectations. Because when you exceed expectations mentally, psychologically, you're a lot happier. And when you get that tax refund, you expected $1,000, but you only got $500.
Yeah,
you're bummed, right?
Yeah, totally.
This is the psychological predisposition. Studies have been done. People feel five times more pain when they lose an investment than when they make money.
But you just said lose an investment, and that's where...
When their portfolio is down.
Right, which they're not losing the investment unless they sell it. So I have to go back to something you just said there. So recently, a friend of mine who's an advisor had me take a risk tolerance. And one of the questions was, how much of a pullback do you feel comfortable with? This is a question on one of these risk tolerances. I'm like, well... And so I asked him about it. I was like, well, if it's a pullback, this was before I ever knew you, right? So if it's a pullback, that doesn't really affect me, right? Because you're not selling myself, are you? And he's like, well, that's the question. It's like, whoa, what do you mean that's the question? So the stock poops itself. It's down 30%. That's when you're going to sell my stuff? What are you doing? And he's like, well, what are you talking about? Well, I don't know. This is what fascinates me about talking to you. You know, a couple of times a month, because the way that you look at all of that is so fundamentally different.
Right. So yes and no on that scenario. I think I know what they're doing. Okay. So there's two things that I think are extremely important here.
Okay.
Number one, we have a proprietary investment policy questionnaire that we use.
Yes.
And one of the, there's a series of questions that get to the psychological or the emotional position of the investor in the question. One of the questions is, where do you start feeling uncomfortable? At a 5% pullback, 10%, 20, 30, or 40? Mm-hmm. If you're uncomfortable with a 20% pullback, then we dig deeper into that and say, okay, but what if you know what you own and why you own it? Are you still as concerned? 99% of the people say no.
Right.
So they move up to 30, right? So now they can tolerate a 30% pullback because they have clarity of what they own in their portfolio. They've just now moved from a balanced type portfolio mentality to a growth in income. And that's a big difference because longer term growth in income performs better than balance, right? So in theory, we are doing the best we can to match the emotional position of the investor to the asset allocation.
Mm-hmm.
Notice it's not a risk questionnaire.
Right.
It's a psychological questionnaire. The second thing that's very important about owning individual stocks, and we say this to our clients all the time, and it's written in our investment policy statement, as it pertains to your portfolio, it is the asset allocation that is far more important than any one company you own in your portfolio. No one company in your portfolio should make or break your portfolio. Now, making your portfolio is easier than breaking because you can only lose as much as the percentage you own, right? But if you make a lot of money, you certainly could have a much bigger impact on the upside. So the point of it is no one company in the portfolio should make or break the long-term performance of the portfolio. It is the asset allocation strategy that is most important. Hence, getting back to praying for the pullback.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you pray for the pullback and the pullback comes, if you've got the right asset allocation strategy, and you've got it measured to the psychological predisposition of the investor, you now have the ability to sharpshoot the companies you want to buy more of when that overall correction happens, because you know it's going to bounce back. Now, you can't say it's guaranteed it's going to pop back, because that's what the regulators say. You can't say that. But historically, that's what's happened, right? So the bottom line is, and it's not about that individual position, it's about every company, if you will, that is within that portfolio in the first place. These are critical components to the overall process of praying for the pullback. The statistics are out there, okay? And I could have read these statistics to the listeners today about pullbacks and what happens with pullbacks and how often. In fact, over the last 4 years, the average intra-year drop is 13.8%. So from top to bottom, every year for the last 40 years, the average was 13.8%. That in of itself, you should just say, okay, the average is 13.8% in a year. I should plan on a 13.8% pullback every year from the top to the bottom. Here's the problem. You know what the problem is. You don't know where the top is.
Yeah.
So this ability to try to guess when to get in and when to get out is a fool's game.
Yeah.
It's gambling. And that's why smart investors will tell you that, quote unquote, investing in the stock market is gambling. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you this funny story. MasterCard. Oh, by the way, no solicitation or recommendation to buy any stocks we're talking about, right? But MasterCard went public in 2006. I believe Visa was in 6 or 7 as well. And during the 2006-2007 campaign there, MasterCard proceeded to go, it went public at 100 and it went to $300 a share, like in 2 years. Okay. The stock was on, it was, as we like to say, Matt, it was en fuego, right? Today, now, 12 years later from 2008, because it bottomed at, so it went from 300 during the financial crisis down to 140. Okay. And today, as we're doing this show, the stock's at $337 a share, 12 years later, right? Oh, shoot, sorry. I forgot to tell you about the 10-for-1 split.
Now, that's kind of an important aspect of what you just forgot there, brother.
Being sarcastic.
Yeah, I know, come on. I know you are, man.
So in other words, it got down to $14 a share in 12 years. It's gone from $14 to $337 a share. The olden days when people bought stocks, when they bought into companies, if they had the right asset allocation strategy, I believe that in many cases they perform, I don't have the stats on this, but they perform better than owning an S&P 500 sure. index fund. But the industry continues to move investors into a cookie cutter, in the box kind of investment mentality. Mm-hmm. I don't think that is investing. And it's no wonder everyone's charging less and less, and yeah. investors are looking for free.
Well,
they ain't getting anything.
They're really not getting any value. I've been to conferences lately, and there's so many people who are so concerned about some of these things, and I'm just, you know, sitting there shaking my head back and forth, thinking, well, you know what? When you have, if you've commoditized yourself because you're really yes. not doing work, then commoditization it makes a reduced pricing. Now, I want to plant a seed because you just said something that we've never freaking talked about, dude, which is splitting. We've never had a podcast on why does a company do this and any of that stuff. I think that would be really interesting to talk about, not necessarily just the splitting idea, but talking about in giving examples like that, like with the MasterCard. And so I just think that would be interesting for me to pick your brain on that.
Yeah. You know, unfortunately, sorry to interrupt you. It's unfortunately, it's a very, very short, easy conversation. Oh.
Well, maybe we'll just start a podcast with that and then we can go ahead and remind me
and I can fill you in.
Okay. I appreciate that. I really do. All right. Closing ideas, brother. Anything else you got for us?
Stick to the process, pray for the pullback, and have your asset allocation appropriate. So when the pullback happens, you can take advantage of opportunities of buying stuff on sale and selling stuff that has made you lots of money and taking a few chips off the table, as they like to say.
Nice. Mark, thanks, man. I appreciate it as always.
My pleasure as usual.
If you have not subscribed to the podcast, make sure you click that subscribe now button below. And this is a great episode for you to share with people because they're going to look at the title and they're going to say, what? What's going on? And then they're going to listen to it and say, okay, now this makes more sense, because we covered a lot of territory on today's podcast. And I love it when Mark does that, because you can see more and more of the method and the systems and the structure that they've really built about around investing with clarity and truly understanding what you own and why you own it and how that can make you just feel overall better about what in God's name is going on with your investment. So for everybody at Nepsis, this is Matt Halloran, and we'll see you on the other side of the mic very soon.
The content discussed is for informational purposes only. It is not a solicitation or recommendation for any securities that may be mentioned herein. Advisory services offered through Nepsis, Inc., an SEC registered investment advisor.